Welcome to APAC Weekly, a showcase of conversations on the APAC network with Asia Pacific's brightest minds. I'm Auriel Morrison. Coming up, the global climate watchdog ranking all countries, new findings about the earliest humans in Southeast Asia, and recovering treasured artworks from across the world. Almost every nation on Earth has signed up to the Paris Agreement, a 2015 pact for international cooperation to tackle climate change. 6 years later, at COP26, 197 countries signed the Glasgow Climate Pact, which acknowledges that commitments made so far won't hit the targets set in Paris. The science is clear. Failure to set and meet tougher goals will have extreme consequences. But measuring success is complex, with countries responding to the challenge in different ways. Esteemed US universities Yale and Columbia have joined forces to create the Environmental Performance Index, ranking 180 countries for their greenness. I'm joined now by Martin Wolf, Principal Investigator for the EPI at the Yale Centre for Environmental Law and Policy. Welcome, Martin. Now, the 2022 numbers are in. It's clearly a dire situation. Now, the results are showing that most countries are not on track to meet net zero goals established in Glasgow. Is this what you expected?
This is unfortunately what we expected. However, we want to also emphasize a message of hope. The best hope that we have to move countries and the whole world towards a more sustainable future, the best hope lies in these data-driven metrics that allow policymakers to comprehend what the latest environmental research is saying and highlight the best policies to put their countries on track towards a more sustainable future.
So let's talk about that then. What are the countries that are on track to reach greenhouse gas neutrality by 2050? What are they doing right?
According to our analyses, there are only a handful of countries that are on track to reach greenhouse gas neutrality by 2050. These countries are Denmark and the United Kingdom and Europe, and then also Botswana and Namibia in Africa. So when you look at what policies leaders like Denmark and the United Kingdom are implementing to reach this climate goal, it's really a broad suite of climate policies, including greenhouse gas charges or taxes that incentivizes the more efficient use of fossil fuels. But also they've actually enshrined in law the goal to reach a certain target, certain emissions threshold by 2030, and ultimately zero or net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. So we see these countries backing up their pledges with concrete and substantive national policies to actually put their countries on track to reach this goal. Mm-hmm.
So how did the Asia-Pacific region, Martin, perform compared with the rest of the world?
The Asia-Pacific region is quite interesting because in that region, we see some of the widest range in scores. At the top, we see countries like Japan, that perform very similarly to other wealthy countries in the global West. And then we see countries like India and Myanmar and other countries that are really struggling across the whole range of sustainability issues that the Environmental Performance Index tracks. The poor performing countries tend to perform poorly for at least two reasons. One, they're prioritizing economic growth at the expense of sustainability. Other poor-performing countries perform poorly because they're suffering from civil unrest, or they lack the financial resources or really the political or governance infrastructures to prioritize natural resource conservation and environmental preservation.
What I found interesting in this report was China and India moving in opposite directions. In fact, India has come out and actually rejected the report. What does this say?
I, too, am interested in the diverging trends that China and India show over the past couple of iterations of the Environmental Performance Index. When we take a really important issue like air quality, for example, 10 years ago, 20 out of the 30 most polluted cities in the world were located in China. China has since recognized the severe environmental public health impacts of poor air quality and unmitigated air pollution emissions, and they've implemented policies to successfully reverse those trends. So air quality in China is still certainly poor, don't get me wrong, but we've seen air quality kind of plateau in many circumstances in many cities for many air pollutants that started to improve. Air pollution in India, however, continues to get worse, driving India's poor performance in the 2022 Environmental Performance Index.
Now, Martin, you started off our conversation today talking about optimism, and you've interestingly enough found a strong correlation between EPI scores and government effectiveness and rule of law. So how much has environmental policy making improved in recent years?
We've seen it improve in certain countries and unfortunately backslide in other countries. When we look at who the poor performing countries are in the overall EPI, we see countries like Myanmar and Haiti fall towards the bottom of the 180 countries in the ranking. These countries are, of course, suffering from civil unrest, so there's a lack of good governance. And we're somewhat fearful of these countries' ability to sustain economic growth or prosperity as they move into the future. On the other side of the coin, however, there are a lot of countries that have successfully decoupled their economic growth from environmental degradation. These are countries like Denmark, whose economy is growing and their quality of life is increasing, while they're successfully on track to meet many of the internationally agreed upon sustainability targets. And another really interesting point, and something that I find quite optimistic, is that we found a strong correlation between the happiness of residents within a country and their overall EPI score. So by that I mean people living in countries with stronger environmental performance end up being happier. And this makes sense from a psychological perspective. We know how beneficial it can be to our mindsets and our happiness. So I think that there's a whole range of arguments to be made for pursuing a more sustainable pathway towards a more sustainable future. It's not only environmentally beneficial, but it's also economically beneficial. And from a public health and mental health perspective, it can be beneficial in these ways as well.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had a notable effect on the way we work, from the remote work environment to Zoom meetings and increasing demands for flexibility. But for some corporates, drawing people back to the office is essential and involves a new way of thinking when it comes to office space. From support spaces to respite rooms and cafes, spaces are being designed to be as flexible and adaptable as possible. Well, to talk more about the new work order, I'm joined by Professor Lan Snell, Head of the Business School and Dean at the University of Southern Queensland. Professor, welcome. Great to have you back with us today. What is the new work order?
Well, the new work order is a new way of working and living and learning, and COVID has really brought this upon us. And it now asks us to re-examine the very definition of what is work. In your introduction, you mentioned how the office world has changed fundamentally. I mean, even before COVID hit, we saw the leading organisations, the global tech players, for example, trying to entice and retain talent via bean bags, vending machines, you know, open spaces and collaboration. Well, COVID came along and everyone had to go home and, you know, stay home in lockdowns, etc. What does that new workspace look like going forward? Well, I think the answer to that is anything goes. It's flexible. It is definitely hybrid. But when you come into the office, what do you actually do in the office? If you're coming into the office and sitting alone in your siloed space, tapping away at your computer, well, that's really not what we're wanting out of our workforce now anyway. So this is about team collaboration. So I do think it is a redefinition of the meaning of work itself. In addition to that, if I may add, there are three other elements that when we consider this new work order, these are characteristics, including the creative economy. So we've had this sort of shift in, say, the gig economy, the sideline hustles, to now this whole thing about creating your own content. Content is king, and certainly now with the different platforms available, have TikTok, I can become my own influencer and run my own business. So creative economy is in full play right now. We're also seeing reconceptualization from jobs of the future to jobs with the future. So we're talking about the future-proofing of yourself as a professional. And then finally, we're talking about the whole premium of learning as an attractor and retainer of talent.
So add into this conversation then, Professor, the actual engagement and communication and the different ways of doing that, whether or not you're working remotely or working from a new type of office space.
Yeah, and that's such an important aspect. What we've learnt most is that regular, frequent communication, be that by Zoom or other mechanisms or other tools, is crucial. What an interesting development that we've seen through our research is the importance of lived-in experience in that authentic communication. So it's not good enough for me to check in on my team as a leader by just asking inauthentic questions. You know, how are you going? I know it's hard, but to share my own vulnerability. And in doing so, that communication piece becomes a lot more relevant and it resonates more, and that point of communication and connectivity has a new dimension entirely.
So what should companies, what should corporates be doing now to essentially future-proof, to use your own words, and to identify areas where they need to change?
Yeah, the common pain point across a lot of organisations, big or small, public or private, is how might I attract and retain talent through professional and continuous learning. You know, if we are to accept the literature findings in terms of even Gen X being a two-year switch or itch period, that I'm going to switch, why would I invest in my people if they're just going to go somewhere else? So the question is that I want to make sure that there is continuous growth there. So how might I do this? Some of the best practices that we're seeing from organisations is creating some sort of like a resource mapping hub area where we're going to look at each individual who's got that potential to grow within the organisation. Now, their current skill set may be redundant in the next 2-3 years because of automation and digital disruption. And so therefore, it's incumbent on us as an organisation to support their training and pivot them in other ways.
A new scientific paper labelled The Talking Dead has shed new light on the cultural practices of the earliest humans of Southeast Asia. Australian National University's Dr. Sophia Sampacaro is the author of the paper and she joins me now. Sophia, let's start with your team's amazing discovery on Alor Island in Indonesia. What exactly did you find?
Well, it was, as you just said, it was a really exciting discovery. So what we found was three different burials, that each of them were from a different time period, but they were all in the same, exactly in the same kind of rock shelter and in the same position. So it was really interesting to find these three different burials that we know they are from, they are dated to different periods, but all located in specifically the same rock shelter.
And what state were the bones in, given the huge amount of time they'd been there?
Well, they were pretty good, I would say. I've seen worse, I would say. So they were quite good, and that gave us the opportunity to study their living conditions before we found them in the burials.
How could you verify the timing, the exact years of how long they were there for?
Well, what we use is what is called relative chronology. So what we usually use is material that we find in the same archaeological context. So, for example, charcoal, or sometimes we can date the teeth from the individuals or some artifacts that are related to the individuals. So, for example, ornaments, things that we know they kind of belong to the same individual. So we get a date from that material and then we can kind of extrapolate to the burial and how old they are.
So what are we learning from all of this? Tell us why the discovery was so significant to our understanding of the early human population in the region.
They are showing us different cultural practices. So they are showing us how these different communities were burying their dead people, right? Their relatives, we assume. And to me, that tells us a lot about the society, because the way we look after our relatives or the way we buried these people that were important for us, I believe it tells a lot about how people behave, what kind of social constructions we have, what type of cultural beliefs we have. So what was really interesting was to find that each of these burials represent a different type of burial, right? So one of them was buried in a way that they removed some of the bones, but they left some of them in the ground, let's say, or they buried some of them and the other ones were removed. Another one was buried in a seated position, so they somehow managed to wrap the body to make it sit before they bury it. And the bottom one, she was buried on the oldest one, the 13,000-year-old one. She was buried on the side, but also with all these ornaments, with fish hooks, all these really valuable artifacts that obviously inform us on how important this person would have been for that community or that group.
Well, it was published in a scientific journal, PLOS ONE, but you called it The Talking Dead. Why was that?
Well, because I wanted to make this, to share this idea of these burials, the dead people, dead individuals at the end, they are talking to us. They are telling us, giving us information on how they were living. So that's why I call it The Talking Dead.
And what did you learn about the migratory nature of the people during the Pleistocene to the Holocene periods?
So what I found really interesting was when I started looking at how they were buried, I could see that these type of burials, they happen in different islands around Alor, so in other Indonesian islands or in mainland Southeast Asia, for example, but it happened in different time periods. And some of them seem to come, let's say, east to west. So this tradition seems to come from PNG, or what was in the time Sahul, so coming from the east towards mainland Southeast Asia, while some of these traditions, they appear earlier in mainland Southeast Asia, and then we find them in the islands. Then we compare this information from the burials, from the cultural practices, to what we know from the genetics. And it kind of confirm or support our idea of there is this, the island Southeast Asia was this area where people were moving east, west, west, east, going around and migrating and sharing or bringing with them all this knowledge and all these practices.
The search for hand-drawn artwork produced by the Australian First Nations children who were forcibly taken from their families in the 1940s continues. A selection of the landscapes found have been displayed in an exhibition run by Curtin University in the UK. The project soon moving to Scotland, where it's hoped more drawings and paintings will be found. Joining us now is Michelle Broome, John Curtin Gallery's Australian First Nations art curator. Michelle, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you with us today. Tell us about this global search.
Well, in the early 1950s, an English philanthropist by the name of Mrs. Florence Rudder visited Perth and came across an article about artworks being created at a native settlement in the southwest, in the great southern region of Katanning, called Karalup. And she found an incredible cohort, I guess, a group of young teenage children and younger with their teacher, Mr. Noel White. And she purchased some of the artworks and she toured them all around the world. The artworks that are touring at the moment are part of a collection that returned to Western Australia from New York. They had been in their stores for nearly 40 years. The old girl fell ill and had sold them to an American collector.
Michelle, what sort of outcome do you hope will come from this search and from these displays?
Well, what we hope is that we can, I guess, recover or rediscover some of the artworks that were sold by Mrs. Rudder in the early 1950s in the UK. We're appealing to families, to communities, even to institutions, maybe triggering some people's memories that may have been to exhibitions or even purchased some of those works, with the idea of reconnecting those works to the families here. Mm. Because in Western Australia, there are many descendants of the children, the child artists of Karalup. Mm. And we see that as, you know, being an important part of a process of truth-telling and part of the journey of healing for those families. And we hope that that's the case. So there is a big call out, but there's also lots of conversations. These exhibitions are facilitating around empire and the stolen generations and the impact that's had on our communities. So there is a broader conversation happening around the exhibition, but really the focus is to, I guess, recover some of those artworks.
What sort of response are you getting at this point in time to the exhibition, and what sort of response do you hope to get in terms of retrieving some of this lost artwork?
Well, the both of the venues and their staff are really on board with that that key objective, and so they're helping with that appeal, and even putting, you know, signage outside the Portico Library, for example. The conversations are really helped to stimulate some, you know, broaden that conversation and reach people that may not necessarily be able to get to the gallery itself. And so we think the more people that we can reach, the better chance we have of locating some of those artworks.
Michelle, what sort of outcomes do the daughters, the sons, the families of the artists hope to achieve from this exhibition?
Look, I'm not going to really speak on their behalf, because I think that requires us to pick up on those conversations more locally. But from our perspective and the Carol Upton Elders Reference Group perspective, there's a lot of value in reconnecting with material cultures of our people, especially because they've been created by children who were stolen from their parents and experiencing a lot of trauma, and that the artwork actually quite often, in not in all cases, but quite often gave them the out that they needed to help with their trauma.
Bangladesh has started laying the groundwork for its first fully fledged trade agreement, soon to begin negotiations with India. The leaders of the two nations have agreed to sign a comprehensive economic partnership. Our Bangladesh correspondent, Redwan Ahmed, joins us now. Redwan, welcome once again. What stage is the significant trade agreement currently at?
Thanks for having me here, Jason. So, as you know, this kind of joint agreements is only get momentum when the top-level government officials get together. In 2021, when Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi visited Bangladesh, and then the Prime Minister of Bangladesh and Modi, they decided they would be doing this joint feasibility study if they could do a free trade agreement between the two countries. So cut to 2022, Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, she visited India last month, and in at the end of their meeting, Prime Minister Modi and Hasina, they issued a joint statement that the bilateral negotiations would start happening at the end of this year.
I mean, the country has been lobbying with major trading partners for years to get free trade agreements signed. Why has it been so difficult, do you think?
Well, Bangladesh have been, it's true that Bangladesh have been trying to get into a lot of free trade agreements, or FTAs per se, but it is successful in only a handful of, you know, regional blocks. But there is no, Bangladesh currently has no bilateral free trade agreements in any countries. So there are a few domestic issues as well. So whenever this kind of FTAs happen and the country has to cut revenue on the tariff section, the duties get decreased. And there's also a few issues, like the country has to sign a lot of like international agreements, like, you know, most of them centering labor rights, good governance, protection of environment and protection of human rights. So, you know, there's a lot of factors that Bangladesh is still working on.
So once the deal with India is finally inked, what does the upside look like for Bangladesh and its people?
So India is Bangladesh's second biggest trading partner after China. So, you know, if there is a certain agreement, like the, we are calling the Comprehensive Economic Partnership Act, which is also called SEPA, this FTA, so Bangladesh's GDP might have increased by 1.72%. And, you know, Bangladesh already does a lot of trading with India. It's only recently, in the last fiscal year, they hit $2 billion export incomes. So this will significantly go up once this agreement comes to effect.
How would you say this agreement will play into Bangladesh making the UN status graduation from an LDC, a least developed country, to a developing nation by 2026?
Well, this is, in fact, a very big reason the experts have, you know, suggested and urged Bangladesh to join in this agreement or this free trade agreement. India will have slightly more gain from this this agreement because, you know, already they have a very diversified export portfolio. So Bangladesh might see a slight decrease in their revenue or income temporarily. Bangladesh will gradually graduate from least developed countries to a developing nation by the end of 2026.
Thank you for joining us on APAC Weekly. I'm Aurel Morrison. To stay across the important conversations shaping our future, visit us at apacnetwork.com.